Chapter 61
"What the hell are you doing here?" snarled Steve Pritchard, the front desk sergeant. He apparently had the graveyard shift tonight and was not happy about it. "We're here to see our client," said Dash calmly. "Your client? Douglas Kemper. I understand he was booked for a double homicide. I presume an alleged murderer would not be able to post bail."
"He's here, but you can't see him."
"How many years you got to your pension, Steve?"
5, why? Growled Pritchard.
"Because you're never gonna make it with that attitude."
A pulse beat in the blue vein at the cop's temple.
"You threatening me?"
"No, just stating a fact. Rogers versus California, 1934. Cops denied a suspect seeing his attorneys and private investigators. All charges were dropped, a writ of habeas corpus was issued by the court, and the suspect walked free. And the cop who did the denying was busted down to riding in a prowler for a month. Then for good measure they canned his ass 7 months before his full ride kicked in. You want to go down that road, Stevie boy, it's okay by me."
He glanced at Archer.
"Let's go wake up Kemper's lawyer and get the lawsuit filed before this lug uses what little brain he has and comes to his senses."
"You ain't bullshitting me?"
Pritchard barked. "Look it up, Steve. You can read, can't you?"
Pritchard glanced at Archer and then grabbed a set of keys off a hook. He pointed a big finger at Dash.
"Just one night I hope to run into your fat ass all alone on a dark street."
"Why, Steve, you ain't one of them guys that likes guys, are you?"
Pritchard's face flushed. But before he could say anything, Dash continued,
"Our client, before I really get mean."
Pritchard led them back to the holding cells and over to the cage containing Kemper. He was seated on a metal bench, his back to the wall, and his collar and necktie still undone. His very expensive suit jacket rested on the bench next to him. He had a shiner on one eye and some hardened blood on his lip. As Pritchard unlocked the door, Dash said,
"Who roughed him up? You?"
"He tripped and hit that handsome puss of his on the wall," said Pritchard with a grin.
"How is it that everybody who gets arrested in this town suddenly forgets how to walk?"
Dash eyed Pritchard in the ring of keys.
"Call Ernie in here."
"Why?"
"Because I'm not letting you lock us in there and then forget you did."
"I don't know if he's here."
"He's here, and I know Pickett's not."
Pritchard left and came back with Prettyman, who said,
"William, sorry." "I know. Now take the keys from Steve and sit down with us, and maybe you'll learn something along with me and Archer."
After Pritchard left, they all sat across from Kemper.
"Which one did that?"
asked Dash, pointing to his injuries.
"Does it matter?"
"Probably not. Heads up for you. The elevator guy at my building named Earl had his throat cut, and Dr. Myron O'Donnell has a third eye. I'm thinking O'Donnell was the target, though they clumsily tried to make it look like a narcotic steal."
Kemper sat up straight, looking scared. "What the hell is going on?"
"That's what we're going to find out."
Archer interjected, "You told us that O'Donnell had performed a recent surgery on your wife for appendicitis?"
"That's right."
"And you said her mother and father had used O'Donnell as well?"
added Dash.
"Yes.
Eleanor caught her arm on a piece of machinery at the shop where she kept her plane. She lost a lot of blood, but O'Donnell fixed her right up good as new. And Sawyer had to have an operation after a car accident years ago."
Dash said, "Now, whose idea was it for you to run for mayor?"
"It was my idea."
"Armstrong didn't put you up to it?"
"Look, I know everyone thinks I'm his lapdog, but the fact is I don't need help from him. When I told him I was running, he raised no objection, but I'm funding the campaign myself. He hasn't put up one dime, nor would I take it if he offered."
"He led us to think that he was supporting you," said Archer.
"Did I? Well, maybe I did, but he's not."
"Why did you come to me to look into this blackmail scheme?"
"I asked my lawyer. He knew about you."
"And does your lawyer know your father-in-law?"
"Well, yes. Sawyer recommended the guy to me.
But what does that have to do with anything?"
"Your wife called Armstrong tonight," explained Archer. "He showed right up."
"I bet he did," Kemper muttered.
"Whenever father and daughter are together, she becomes a different person, and not in a good way."
Kemper seemed to appraise Archer in a new light.
"You just described my marriage."
He paused and ran a hand through his hair.
I love Beth. From the moment I saw her, I was nuts about the woman. I loved her mother, too. Eleanor was a dynamo, and Beth took after her. He paused again. That was when Sawyer wasn't around. When he was, Beth just clammed up, became a totally different person, like you said. She'd defer to him on all subjects, took his side against me. It made me mad. It enraged me, in fact.
And how did you manifest that rage, Mr. Kemper?
Said Dash. I never touched a hair on her head, and I never would. But I started going out on my own, pretended to play the field, acted like some sort of sap you'd see in the movies, slept in separate rooms. I guess part of me thought it would make Beth jealous. The only thing it did was...
It drew her to Benjamin Smalls, said Archer. They were having an affair, weren't they?
Ironic, since you were the one playing the ladies' man, but had remained faithful.
I don't blame Beth for what she did. I feel like I drove her to it. And I know Sawyer was in the background, feeding her all sorts of lies about me, trying to destroy our marriage, and he intimated to me that Beth was sleeping with our chauffeur, Adam Stover. I didn't want to believe it, but it made me suspicious.
Yeah, we met Handsome Muscle Boy. He's definitely not your wife's type.
But you made Armstrong's job easy, you dope, pointed out Dash.
But I never did anything with the woman who was killed, and I sure as hell would never have murdered Wilson.
He paused and looked at Archer.
Why do you know about the island? What the hell would anyone do with it?
Well, I think your father-in-law is planning to build a huge casino complex on it, answered Dash.
Prettyman interjected, You can't have a casino in California, Willie.
That chunk of rock ain't part of California, retorted Dash before turning to Kemper. Your country club that has the marina and Big Dock. Does Armstrong have an ownership interest in that?
Yes. It was my first big project. I needed his backing.
What's the ownership split?
50-50.
Not to be blunt, but what happens to it if you get gassed in the chamber at San Quentin? Said Dash.
Kemper paled.
Beth gets everything that I own.
Meaning, realistically, Armstrong will own it all.
Yes, I suppose so. Beth just can't seem to say no to him.
Archer said, The day Eleanor Armstrong died in that plane crash, Beth was supposed to go up with her, but instead she went to a luncheon that you had arranged. How did that come to pass?
It was Sawyer. He really arranged the luncheon, and he insisted that Beth be there.
I think Armstrong told Beth that it was your idea, not his. Kemper slowly nodded.
It seemed like the light went out of our marriage after Eleanor's death.
Dash glanced at Prettyman.
Carl's going to come up with anything he can to lock me and Archer up, so we're going to have to lie low for a bit.
Okay, Willie, but watch your back.
Helen, you know I'm as familiar with my back as I am my front.
They walked out of the cell, where Dash buttonholed Prettyman out of Kemper's earshot.
Okay, here's the deal, Ern. You got any guys on the force who actually know Pickett's a bad cop, or who aren't on the take themselves?
Yeah, sure, a few.
Good. Call them in, and have them help you play Guardian Angel. If Kemper bites it, all my plans go sideways.
Archer and Dash left.
Where to now, Willie? Asked Archer.
Midnight moods.
Why?
I have to ask Mabel Dawson about an old vaudeville performer named Guy Parnell.
And that case you told Pritchard about? Rogers versus California?
The technical term for that, Archer, is bullshit. But it's all in how you sell the line.
Chapter 62 They found Dawson backstage watching Callahan perform another set. Dash glanced at the packed house, checked out Callahan doing a song and dance routine, and said,
And tell me again how you're not the luckiest sap on earth, Archer?
It's complicated.
In my day it wouldn't have been.
Dash eyed Dawson.
Okay, Mabel, we need to talk.
Not now, I'm busy.
There have been two more murders.
Here?
She snapped.
No, but they're connected. Now why did you kick Guy Parnell loose early?
Dawson slowly turned to look at him, as Callahan belted out Dinah Shore's I'll Walk Alone.
Archer thought, well, that song fits her to a T.
Dawson said,
I guess he had a change of plan.
Dash shook his head.
It's what we in the business call a rhetorical question, Mabel, because I already know the answer.
I dropped enough coins to talk to Parnell long distance. He's in Detroit with an extra $500 in his pocket on top of his full seasonal wages, courtesy of you.
She licked her suddenly dry lips.
I don't recall.
Sure you do. Armstrong told you to do it, and so you did what you always do when Armstrong tells you to do something. Now the question is why he wanted you to do it.
Is this another rhetorical question?
Asked Dawson, looking ill now.
Yeah, it is. They needed his room to kill Fraser and Sheen. They transported Fraser from that room to hers after she was dead, using the connecting attic space between the two rooms. They left Sheen in Parnell's old room after the poor guy was murdered.
Dawson took a deliberate step back.
I don't know nothing about that.
Dash shook his head and smiled.
Come on, Mabel. You're up to your baby blues in this, honey. See, you told us Fraser liked rich men. Now who's the richest of all in this town and a widower and available to boot?
You're nuts. Armstrong's almost old enough to be your grandfather.
You'd be surprised at how millions in dough can make people seem a lot younger. So you arranged for poor Ruby to meet up with Armstrong in Parnell's old room. Only it was Tweedledee and Tweedledum in there, not Armstrong. They pretended her throat was a stake, and then they deposited the lady in her own room through the crawl space after cleaning up the blood. When you went looking for her, why do you think you skipped Parnell's old digs? If you'd opened that door and seen them cutting up poor Ruby, they might have had to kill you too.
This is crazy talk, Willie,
said Dawson.
Then why are your eyebrows sweating? Armstrong already knows what I'm about to tell you, and here it is. You are what we call in the business a loose end. He's had 4 people killed so far. What's one more, sweetie? You get my drift, or are you under the delusion that you're actually something special?
Dawson plops down in a chair that Archer had hastily drawn up for her while Callahan launched into Sinatra's 5 minutes more. Dash knelt down next to her and gently patted her hand.
Come on, Mabel. I got nothing against you, and I bet you didn't know what they were going to do to poor Ruby.
She shook her head and said in a hushed voice,
I didn't. I swear to God. I thought I was doing her a favor. You know, hooking her up with money. The poor kid. Why? Why would they do that to her?
She was just a murder to pin on somebody else, said Dash. Look, you got someplace safe out of town you can go to for a few days?
My sister's, in Long Beach.
Okay, but first we're going to my office. I'm going to have an affidavit typed up and you're going to sign it.
What affidavit?
She said, her eyes bugging out at the man.
Just saying what you already told us. I'll get my secretary to come in, type it up, and notarize it.
But then I'll be...
What you'll be is smart. You'll get a deal. No jail time. And your story is memorialized for all to see if need be.
You swear?
So long as you've been square with me on your involvement, yeah. I swear. I'll fix it with the DA. Now go pack a bag and we can drop you off at the bus station after we go by my office. Memory serves, there's a southbound bus that leaves in about 2 hours that stops in Long Beach. You give me your sister's phone number, and I'll be in contact, okay?
She nodded dumbly. Archer went with her while she packed a bag. Then they drove to Dash's office. He had phoned Morrison from Midnight Moods, and she was already there waiting. Archer looked at Morrison, all efficiency and professionally outfitted at this time of night, and wondered if she just waited by the phone all night for a call from Dash to say he needed her. Dash and Dawson wrote out what she was willing to say, and Morrison typed it up in triplicate. Dawson signed 3 times, and Morrison notarized all of them. After that, they drove Dawson to the Greyhound terminal. She said,
Since I signed that paper, will you still need me?
We'll have to see how it plays out. If it goes to trial, I'll personally come and get you.
They watched her get on the bus 10 minutes later. Archer said,
So we can bring it all down with her affidavit? Not even close, Archer. He said, she said. And unfortunately, Armstrong's words will carry far greater weight than a dame who runs a burlesque.
So why'd you ever do it?
Every little bit helps, and it was a way to scare her into getting to a safe place.
That was good of you, Willie.
I don't have much good in me, Archer, but when it does come out, it feels pretty swell. Can I take another pull on your flask?
Archer handed it to him. After Dash gave it back, Archer stared down at it, as something occurred to him. An awful something. He said, "Look, I just had a thought and need to run it down. You gonna be okay?"
"When Pickett and his clowns finish there, I'm going back to the doc's office."
"Why's that?"
"To figure out why somebody needed to kill Myron O'Donnell."
Chapter 63 Archer looked all over Midnight Moods until he found the old gent. He was the one Wilma Darling had pointed out to him the night they'd been having a drink on the terrace. He had the same lovely young lady sitting in his aged lap. Archer asked his questions and got his answers, which he grimly accepted, as they proved his forming hunch correct. Then he drove straight to Wilma Darling's bungalow, where he confirmed that the Ford coupe was gone and the place was empty. Next, he pulled out his map and saw the general direction he needed to take. He figured 40 minutes if he made the Delahaye get real excited. He kept the pedal to the floor, and 38 minutes later he pulled into Ventura. He stopped at an all-night dance club, where people seemed to be having a good time without getting murdered, and asked for directions to his final destination. The bouncer actually knew the address and told Archer how to get there.
"That's Wilma's place," said the man,
a beefy gent with a bald head and hands the size of watermelons. "Her place?"
"Yeah. Hey, you one of her customers?"
"Customers?" Archer said, puzzled. Then he quickly recovered and said, "Yeah, yeah, I am. Any idea where she is?" The bouncer's friendly features fell away as it was clear he did not believe Archer.
"Forget it, Mac, just forget it. Now beat it, I got work to do."
He walked away, leaving Archer deeply disturbed. The house was a one-story stucco with a red tile roof and enough plants, trees, and flowers to hide it from its neighbors. Its backyard was basically the ocean. A storm was drifting in, as Archer had found storms often did around here. It was like the Pacific wanted the coastal residents to be as wet as it was. The Ford coupe wasn't in the carport. The porch light was on, and that was it for illumination at this time of night. He pulled the Delahaye farther down the road and out of sight of the house. He got out and flitted back up the quiet street. He chanced looking in the mailbox and pocketed a couple of pieces of mail he found in there, which told him a lot, although the bouncer had already done that. He next circled back around, jumped a fence of the house next door to hers and traversed the backyard, where the smell of charcoal from a recent cookout competed with the eucalyptus trees for dominance of his nostrils, although he could still smell his sweat and the stink of fear that went along with it. Archer squatted down behind the fence separating Darling's place from her neighbor's. He waited for a few minutes there, reconnoitering the land in front of him. Finally satisfied, he gripped the top of the wooden fence and easily propelled himself over, landing in the wiry grass of Darling's yard. He threaded his way up to the back door and tried the knob. It was locked. He didn't have Dash's lockpick kit, but he had a pocket knife. The blade was enough to push back the simple latch. The next moment he was inside, and on the wrong side of the law, where Archer was getting to be more comfortable than was probably good for him. He moved through to the kitchen, where he found a small refrigerator that held a glass jug of buttermilk, 2 eggs, a bunch of apples, and a wedge of cheese. The buttermilk smelled fresh. In the living room, he saw the monogrammed cigarette lighter on a table. Okay, here we go. Archer sat down in a chair facing the front door and waited. He checked his timepiece. It was almost 4 in the morning, and he had never felt further from sleep. It was like every nerve in his body was doing the jitterbug. 30 minutes later, the beams from a car's headlights cut across the front window. He sank down a bit deeper in his chair. He heard the car door open and close and listened to the high heels poking into the sidewalk until their owner arrived at the front door. A key was inserted and the door opened, and there she was. In the illumination of the porch light, he could see that she wore a narrow-brimmed, angled hat, a dark green dress that flared out from the hips, and a white, short-waisted jacket, long white dress gloves, and green pumps that lifted her impressive height ever more skyward. Her purse hung over her forearm. She looked like a knockout, thought Archer, and that cut both ways. Archer eyed the purse and thought about the 2 things of importance that might be inside it, because he knew they weren't in here. She closed the door behind her, flicked on a switch, and dark became light. And Archer went from invisible to revealed. She froze, and then gasped, her hand flying to her chest, which was heaving. That sight made Archer feel better.
You scared the hell out of me. How did you get in here?
Back door was unlocked.
No, it wasn't. I distinctly remember locking it.
You missed my meaning. I unlocked it. Her fearful expression faded and was replaced with a look that under other circumstances might have intimidated Archer. But not tonight.
Explain yourself.
I need a drink. Couldn't find one in here. Got your flask? She opened her purse and looked inside it.
I've got rye, is that okay?
When she looked up, Darling was staring down the barrel of the .38. She coolly eyed the gun.
If you don't want the rye, Archer, just say so.
Yeah, I wish a funny line would cut it, Wilma. Have a seat and take it real slow. Anything fast or sudden from you would not be healthy. And hand your purse over.
What? Are you an armed robber now? It doesn't suit you, Archer. Admit it. You're a goody-two-shoes.
She tossed the purse to him. He caught it in one hand and set it on the table next to his chair while he watched her perch on the settee across from him and cross her long legs at the ankles, her gloved hands in her lap as prim and proper as could be.
You want to tell me what this is all about?
You never should have given me the address of this place, you know.
Yeah, I'm starting to see that was a mistake.
But it's a nice place, Wilma. Real nice. Cost a pretty penny, no doubt.
It's not mine. I'm just renting it for a few days. And you told me to come here.
Starting off with a lie? Not the way I want this to go.
I'm not lying, Archer.
She said smoothly. He pulled the letters from his pocket and tossed them down on the table that sat between them. People don't have mail addressed to a place they're renting for a few days. She looked at the letters with her name and this address on them. Archer could see the wheels spinning as she tried to think of a plausible counter to what he'd just said. But then her expression finally showed that she had come up empty.
So what?
She said. Yeah, so what? And tack on to that, the bouncer at the nightclub near here knew this as your place. He opened her purse and took out the flask. And so what that on the drive to your place after Sheen got croaked, you asked for a drink from my flask when you had this one in your purse? But then you couldn't drink from this one without getting very, very sleepy. Like Sheen when you slipped him the Mickey. You lured him to the room on the pretense of showing him a good time. You let him ride you till he had his fill, and then he went Betty by courtesy of what was in your flask. He got dressed and left, and someone else came in, maybe Hank and or Tony, and they introduced a hole through Sheen's heart that he didn't have before.
You're talking nonsense, Archer.
He cocked his head at her and waggled the .38.
You think I could sleep with you, knowing that somebody was killing Wilson? I'm not a monster, Archer.
You got me out of midnight moods for one reason only. When we were sitting on that terrace, you looked over my shoulder and your gaze froze on something. You told me it was the old guy with a taste for young gals. He said he and Kemper were doing a deal. I asked him about that tonight. He doesn't even know Kemper, and he doesn't do deals. You lied to me, Wilma. I don't like that.
Why would I lie?
Because who you really saw over my shoulder was whoever killed Sheen. They were giving you the high sign, and I told you I was going to go look for Sheen. You couldn't have that. So what did you do? You invited me to your place for a little fun between the sheets, and I forgot all about Wilson Sheen until you got the call the next morning. And since I was with you at all relevant times, you got yourself a prime alibi to boot. It was on the fly and neatly done, I'll give you that. She took a cigarette from the bowl and lit it.
You're nuts.
Am I? I'd explain it all like they do in the detective novels, but it would take too much time, and you already know what I'm going to say.
You're making me out to be some criminal.
You made yourself out to be one by committing criminal acts. Funny how that works. He took out a pill box from her purse and withdrew a pill from it. I saw this pillbox in your purse before, but it was empty. And that same bouncer asked me if I was a customer of yours. A customer for what, I wonder? Darling just stared at him, lips pursed, legs still primly crossed at the ankles, the smoke in her hand. You sell drugs, Wilma. He looked at the pill. Amphetamines.
You know about amphetamines, Archer. I'm impressed.
Army used to give them out like candy in the war. Made you not feel tired even though you hadn't slept for days. Made you not feel hungry, so they didn't have to stop the fighting to feed you. Made you act like a lion when you felt like a mouse.
He put the pill back and returned the box to the purse.
And you're also selling to the gals in your office. That's why they could work dawn to dusk and move like someone had stuck their fingers in a wall socket. Must pay well. You got the place in Baytown, this place here, a new car, nice clothes. Yeah, what a success you are.
Everything I have, I worked for.
Oh yeah, you did. And you said you went to Midnight Moods regularly. I'm betting you sold to the gals there too, like Ruby Frazier. You sold her pills. And I'm thinking you were the one who fingered her to be the patsy in all this. Put her at the center of this phony blackmail scheme with Kemper. And then they cut her throat out. And then you set up poor Wilson Sheen and removed any alibi Kemper has for Frazier's murder. You probably got that info from one of them while at the office and passed it along to the appropriate party.
You weave a good tale, Archer. Good thing for me, the cops only care about facts.
Let me give you some, then. They killed Dr. Myron O'Donnell tonight and made it look like a narcotics hit. In the process, they slit the throat of a harmless old man who spent his days going up and down in an elevator reading the Gazette and swigging his cheap rum after a really shitty life. I look down on folks who kill other folks, unless you happen to be in a war. So that makes you an accessory to two more murders, Wilma. Even if they don't send you to the gas chamber, you're getting at least 25 to life.
He checked her purse again. Where's the derringer?
A lady has to protect herself, Archer. You got a gun? Why shouldn't I have a gun?
Under any other circumstances, I would agree with you, but I'm fresh out of understanding right now. So where is it?
I dumped it. It was making me nervous.
He decided to let this pass for now, and kept the gun pointed right at her, his finger on the trigger guard.
So I get no points at all for screwing you, 'cause I know you enjoyed it, lover boy. Guys can't fake it. Only the gals can do that. Only I admit I didn't have to with you.
Yeah, and now that I know the truth about you, I'll be taking 3 showers a day to try to get the stink off.
A girl has to do what a girl has to do to survive, Archer. But being a man, you would have no clue.
I know lots of gals who get by just fine without selling drugs and helping people kill other people.
I never wanted to be like lots of gals.
And thank God lots of gals never want to be like you. I hope the money you got paid was worth it, and I'm betting it was a lot more than a grand.
She hiked her eyebrows.
So where does all this leave you and me?
In a difficult spot.
You have no proof of anything.
That's my difficult spot, but I just wanted to let you know that I know the truth.
How decent of you, Archer. I was half serious when I asked where I could get a dozen of you. Of course, you'd start to bore me at some point. See, I don't like the shiny knights. I like the bad boys, who take what they want when they want.
Yeah, I know all about them. And the bad girls, too, like you.
What a choir boy you turned out to be.
I tell you what, give up Sawyer Armstrong and get a few years shaved off your sentence. He framed his son-in-law for a double murder that Kemper had no part in. Can't let a guy like that walk the last mile to San Quentin.
And why not?
She ground out her cigarette on the tabletop and sat back.
If you have to ask, any explanation I could give you would be a waste of time.
We seem to be wasting a lot of time tonight, Archer. But one thing I wanted you to know.
What's that?
I wasn't surprised to see you here. I was just faking. How'd I do?
I'd rate you right up there with Betty Davis. But why weren't you surprised?
I was at that dance club tonight, and the bouncer's my friend, and he told me all about you.
She did move well, very well. The derringer came out from a pocket on her jacket, and she got off 2 quick shots. Both missed. Archer's did not.
Darling lowered her gun, and then looked down at her front. The dark green cloth was sprouting another color.
The crimson patch kept growing as she looked up at him, her facial muscles as tensed as a person surprised that she is suddenly dying can make them. A bit of blood emerged at the corner of her mouth as the internal hemorrhaging expanded upward. She fell to her knees and glanced up at him. Her mouth moved,
but no words came out. Her head hit the table on the way down. It didn't matter. She didn't feel the impact. The dead felt nothing. Archer looked behind him where the twin Derringer bullets had slammed into the back of his chair, right on either side of him. Part of him thought it would turn out this way. He'd only hoped that part of him would be wrong. He rose and looked down at her. Fleeting images of their first meeting and their lovemaking raced through his thoughts. Part of him felt lucky, part felt depressed, and part of him, maybe the largest part, just felt sick to his stomach. He left the way he had come, after wiping his prints off everything he had touched. If he could have dug the bullet out of her, he would have. Now he had to be worried about getting fingered for her death. He drove fast back to Baytown, because he knew there was more to be done. Chapter 64 Archer rode the storm all the way back. It looked like the entire coast of Southern California was getting the same treatment. On reaching the town limits, he drove straight to his office building. There were no prowlers out front, nor did he see Pickett's big Chrysler. They must have come and gone, thought Archer. Dawn was still over an hour away as the storm continued to rage overhead. He hadn't slept in nearly 24 hours, but he had never felt less tired in his life. Killing a person, particularly a beautiful woman with whom you'd previously slept, just did that to you, he supposed. It didn't make him feel good or bad. He didn't feel anything, really. And he couldn't really handle that, so he stopped thinking about it. He entered the office building through a back entrance and crept along the first floor corridor until he neared the elevator. He got a sight line that showed Earl's body was no longer where it had been before. He moved forward and saw that the car was empty. He passed by it and drew closer to O'Donnell's office. He waited, crouching in the darkened hallway, listening and watching. Satisfied that an army of cops wasn't lurking to bash him in the head, he eased the office door open and peered inside. Empty and dark. He hurried through the reception area and thought to pull his gun just in case. He had 5 shots left in the barrel. He hoped he didn't need any of them. He didn't like the exposed position he was in, but he had to find Dash and fast. He nearly jumped out of his shoes when he heard the voice.
Archer, was that you?
Yeah, it's me. Dash appeared in the doorway leading into the interior hall of the office space. Archer put the gun away.
Where did you go?
Asked Dash. In 60 seconds, Archer told him what had happened and why.
Okay. Wilma, darling, bit the dust. She was in on it. And she was selling drugs on top of it. What a piece of work. Nice catch on the flask. But you've got some exposure there when they find the body.
I know.
We'll have to focus on that later.
What did you find?
Come on, I'll show you.
He led Archer into another room that was filled with metal file cabinets. Dash turned on the light and took a file off the table in there.
What's that? My medical file, Archer. O'Donnell wasn't just a friend, he was my doctor, too.
Okay, said Archer, looking confused. How does that help us?
Lots of good stuff in here. My age, height, weight, medical history, blood type, blood pressure.
He blanched.
Not a number I want to really dwell on, but before you go under the knife, they have to know this stuff.
What'd you have done?
Ulcer surgery.
Yeah, Connie mentioned that.
O'Donnell cut out some of my gut, so most nights I eat cream of wheat and buttermilk.
Should you be drinking, then?
Hell, Archer, I can only get the goddamn cream of wheat down if I do drink.
So did you find anything helpful?
It's what I didn't find that was helpful.
Come again?
What I didn't find were the medical files for Sawyer and Eleanor Armstrong and Beth Kemper. They're missing.
What? Why?
Because I'm sure they provided the same sort of information as mine does. So I sat here going over my file to see what sort of information someone wouldn't want someone else to know. And then I had to take it a step further and see what sort of information someone wouldn't want someone to know when they put all 3 of those files together. See, it's important to note that they didn't take 1 or 2 of the files. They took all 3. And they took them for a reason. You see that, right?
Yeah, when you lay it out like that, it makes sense. So what did you conclude?
I think they took all 3 because the files had their individual blood types. Sawyer's, Eleanor's, and Beth's. You know about blood types?
Sure. They have to know that when they need to give transfusions. Otherwise, it can kill you if they get the blood types mixed up.
That's right, but blood types are important for something besides making transfusions safe.
Like what?
They can prove whether someone isn't the parent of a child.
Archer stiffened, but remained quiet and looked at Dash expectantly.
There was the Charlie Chaplin case back in the early 40s. It happened right here in California. Chaplin slept around, and one woman said she had a child by him. They did a blood test on the kid and Chaplin and the woman to see if he could be the father. Turns out he wasn't the dad, though the jury held him liable for other reasons. But the point is, if the kid has AB blood and the mother has A blood, the father has to have B or AB blood. If not, he's out. Now, it can't say for sure you're the parent if you have one of the right blood types, you see, but it can rule you out for certain, depending on the blood types of the interested parties. Nice thing about science. It is what it is.
Who exactly are we talking about here, Willie? Archer said this, although he was pretty sure he knew the answer.
All three of them, Beth, Eleanor, and Sawyer, were treated by O'Donnell. All three involved surgery, potential blood loss, so all three would have had to have their blood types checked in case they needed a transfusion. Now, Eleanor's and Sawyer's operations were a long time ago,
but Beth's was recent, interjected Archer.
Right, the last piece of the puzzle. I think it occurred to Armstrong how he was exposed on that, and he decided to nip it in the bud, even if O'Donnell hadn't made the connection. But he couldn't take a chance, which is why the doc had to die and the records had to be taken.
So you're saying,
I'm saying that Armstrong is not Beth's biological father.
That means Eleanor had an affair?
Yes.
Any idea who it was? Dash took out his pipe and chewed on the end without lighting it.
I know that Beth Kemper just turned 31. It was in the papers. Well, 31 years ago, I wasn't in this town. But somebody else was.
Who?
Andrew Smalls.
Archer looked startled. Armstrong's partner who killed himself?
Well, maybe he did, and maybe he didn't.
Are you saying he was having an affair with Eleanor?
More than that, Archer, I think he's Beth's father.
But that would make her and Benjamin Smalls
half-siblings,
yeah. Archer scratched his head. Then this is all about what?
Revenge, cruelty, and maybe something else that's sicker than both those put together. The point is, anyone gets close to Beth Kemper gets taken away somehow, some way. Andrew Smalls, Benjamin Smalls,
and her husband, said Archer.
And her mother, added Dash.
Her mother?
But she died in a plane crash. A Stearman plane crash, which is the name of the company that bought that island out there. And everyone in town knows Beth was supposed to go up with her mother that day, but she went to a luncheon with her husband instead. And Kemper told us it was Armstrong who made that happen.
But why kill Eleanor? Because she cheated on him? He sure as hell waited a long time, unless he just found out 2 years ago.
I think it's more complicated than that, Archer. Beth loved her mother far more than she loved Armstrong, and maybe he just couldn't take that anymore. And then in his warped mind, Eleanor had to pay the ultimate price for cheating on him. But everything was just fine until Beth had her surgery. Now O'Donnell had all of their blood types, and I think it was then that he could see for himself that Armstrong couldn't be the father. I can envision Armstrong sitting up there surrounded by his olive trees brooding about it, and once he figured the man had that leverage over him, the doc was as good as dead.
Why would Armstrong think O'Donnell would even put the three together? And why would Armstrong believe that O'Donnell would use it against him?
A good question, and here's my answer. A man like Armstrong believes that everybody else thinks like him, meaning if Armstrong had that information on someone, he would sure as hell use it against them. So he just assumed that O'Donnell would put the screws to him. He sees the world and everyone in it through his own warped perspective. All of his actions are dictated by what is best for him, nobody else.
Okay, let's say that's all true. How does that tie into his blackmail plot against Douglas Kemper? Armstrong's backing him for mayor.
Is he, Archer? Who really told us that? Douglas Kemper never did, quite the opposite, in fact, and Armstrong hedged his bets talking about it. But look at it this way. If Armstrong wants his son-in-law out of his daughter's life, here's what he could do. He sends a blackmail letter to Kemper saying they know he's sleeping around with Frazier. Then Kemper hires us to look into it because Armstrong's lawyer recommended me to him. Frazier denied the affair, since it was all a load of baloney, but that still gives Kemper every motive to kill her. Then she is killed.
And the only guy who can give Kemper an alibi for Fraser's murder is Sheen.
So he dies too, and they frame Kemper for that. Then they got the medical records, and the doc is dead, and that loose end goes away. And Kemper goes to the gas chamber, and Armstrong is left to pick up the pieces with a woman who is not his daughter.
Do you think? Began Archer, his face growing pale as a number of sickening thoughts invaded his mind. Dash looked at him knowingly.
I don't know, Archer, but I do know that Armstrong is one dangerous man.
And what about Benjamin Smalls?
Smalls found out Armstrong was planning to build a casino and had a confrontation with him about it. The law may allow gambling out on that rock, but as mayor, Smalls could have made Armstrong's life miserable and put his scheme in real jeopardy.
But we have no proof of any of this. Dash stroked his chin.
And Pickett is so far up Armstrong's ass you can't even see the man's wingtips.
So what do we do? Asked Archer.
We go see the dentist.
Chapter 65. The sun was breaking through the remnants of the passing storm. Both men stared out the windscreen of the Delahaye as they drove to Alfred Drake's home.
What's your angle on him?
He has a backer, all right, but it's not the Vegas mob. It's Sawyer Armstrong.
Archer jerked the wheel of the car.
Armstrong?
We've been played for dopes, Archer, like everybody else in this business.
You're gonna have to explain that to me.
Drake is a grown-up version of the kid I saw hanging in that room. Armstrong knows it, and I'm betting he has hard proof, and he's blackmailing Drake with it. He'll have to approve whatever the man wants in connection with that casino. And remember what Drake said when we were leaving his house? You asked him if he really believed he had no chance against Kemper, and he said something like, I have no chance, but we'll have to see.
Archer added, and then he said, stranger things have happened.
Right. But the point is, Drake was being literal. He doesn't have a chance against Kemper.
But if Kemper isn't running against him?
Then he's going to win.
But Drake doesn't strike me as a guy to just meekly take it on the chin, will he? Like he pointed out before, the guy fights back. Dash suddenly got a disturbed look on his face.
You're right, Archer, so step on it.
They roared up to the front of the residence, and Dash had his door open before Archer even stopped the car. He ran up and pounded on the front door. It took a while, but the same woman as before answered. She was cinching her robe around her waist, and her hair was disheveled from sleep.
Do you know what time it is?
She began angrily.
We need to see Drake now, said Dash. It's an emergency.
He's asleep, and so was I.
Then we'll wake him up. He pushed past her. Which way?
You can't just...
He grabbed her arm.
Which way, lady? This is life and death.
The woman quickly led them down a long hall to a set of double doors situated at the end of the corridor. Dash tried the door, but it was locked.
Drake, it's Willie Dash. Alfred, open up.
He pounded the wood again. There was no reply from within.
Do you have a key to open it?
He asked the woman. She shook her head.
Archer!
Dash motioned to the door. Archer took a few steps and exploded forward, his shoulders smashing into the wood. It buckled, but did not give. Archer retreated and then charged forward one more time. This time the door flew open and he was in the room. Dash and the woman followed him. She screamed, and Archer just stared. Drake was in a chair. The gun he'd used to kill himself was still in his right hand, his index finger wedged in the trigger guard. He was dressed in a dark blue silk robe with white pajamas underneath. There was a single hole in his right temple. It was blackened and burned in the center and crimsoned with blood on the rim. It looked angry and foul and wrong. Dash walked over, felt his wrist, and leaned in close to check the wound. Finally, he felt the gun muzzle. He glanced up at Archer.
Doesn't seem like he's been dead long.
He looked at the woman, who had finally stopped screaming and was swaying like a pine tree in a windstorm.
When did you see him last?
He asked.
I...
He guided her to a chair as far away from Drake as possible and pointed away from the man's corpse.
Just take a deep breath and collect yourself. I know this must be a shock. Archer, your flask?
Archer drew it from his pocket and passed it over. Dash unscrewed the cap and encouraged the woman to take a sip, which she did. She handed it back and looked up at him.
"What's your name, hon?" asked Dash.
"Ruthie."
"Okay, Ruthie. Just take your time and tell us what you can about last night."
She took another replenishing breath and began.
"Mr. Drake had an early dinner and then sat up reading in the library. Around 9 or so, I saw him go to his room. That's the last time I saw him."
"He seemed okay?"
"He seemed normal. He's never one for small talk, but he didn't seem like a man ready to shoot himself either."
"Did you hear any noises, like a gunshot?"
She shook her head.
"Me and the cook sleep at the other end of the house. This is Mr. Drake's private wing. I didn't hear anything. Not until you knocked on the door."
"Okay. Did he have any visitors last night? Phone calls? Get any messages delivered?"
"No. Nothing like that. It was a typical evening."
She glanced at Drake's body and shuddered. Dash eyed the phone on the nightstand. He picked it up and dialed.
"Yeah, I want to talk to Ernie Prettyman. Tell him it's Willie Dash."
He paused and then stiffened.
"When?" "Shit. Okay."
He slammed down the phone and looked at Archer.
"Ern's in the hospital, unconscious. Some goons jumped him and the two guards guarding Kemper."
"And Kemper?"
"Looks like they took him. Son of a bitch."
He picked up the phone again and stared at it like he'd never seen one before. Turning to Ruthie, he said,
"But you wouldn't know if Drake called someone, would you?"
"No, sir. I would have no way of knowing that."
"Willie,"
exclaimed Archer. Archer was kneeling and looking down at the carpet near a set of French doors opening to the outside. Dash hurried over to him. "It was raining up until about an hour ago," said Archer. Dash examined the wet footprints on the carpet.
"Those weren't made by Drake. They're too short."
Archer opened one of the French doors. "Not locked." Dash walked over to the woman.
"Ruthie, that young fellow we saw planting a bush when we were here before, who is he?"
"You mean Bobby?"
"Yeah, Bobby."
"He's the gardener. Takes care of everything outside."
"He live here?"
Ruthie nodded.
"In a room over the garage."
"Thanks."
Chapter 66. They heard the sobs as they approached the garage. They cut through the still morning air like a machete through bamboo. The garage was a three-bay setup with a full floor above, where, presumably, Bobby lived. The exterior door was locked, but Archer managed to push up one of the garage doors and they went inside, passing a Buick and a trim little green Hunter convertible with the canvas top down on their way to the set of interior stairs. The sobs were now even louder, and in them Archer thought he could hear an anguish associated with only the deepest of personal losses. They reached a doorway at the top of the stairs. The cries continued, with the person inside seemingly oblivious to their presence. Dash whispered,
"Pull your heater, Archer, just in case."
The gun came out. Archer stepped in front of Dash, put his hand on the doorknob, and slowly rotated it. The next moment, he eased the door open and peered into the room. The space was small, with bead-boarded, whitewashed walls and plenty of windows to let the emerging dawn peek through. One of the windows was open. That was no doubt how they could hear the crying all the way outside. On the wall were framed publicity stills of Cary Grant, Montgomery Clift, and other male actors. A two-drawer dresser painted a pale blue, some built-in cabinetry, a banjo leaning in one corner, and a mahogany four-poster bed were the only things to be seen, other than the young man lying in the bed and sobbing his heart out. Archer and Dash stepped into the room, and Archer closed the door behind him hard enough to make the man sit up and stare in fear and confusion at them.
Who are you?
Dash came forward.
You're Bobby, right?
Yes, sir.
He sat up and pulled the covers up over his bare chest. Seeing him up close, Archer figured he was no more than 20 years old, with fine, delicate facial features and large blue eyes.
I'm Willie Dash, and this here is Archer. We're private eyes. You know about your employer, I take it?
Bobby wiped his eyes and nodded.
He shot himself. Did you see him too?
Yeah. Hey, Bobby, let me see your hands for a sec.
Bobby held out his hands, and Dash wiped them with his pocket handkerchief. He looked at the cloth and then sniffed it.
Well, you didn't fire that gun.
I would never hurt anyone, especially Mr. Drake.
Okay, calm down, and tell us all about it.
Bobby glanced at Archer, who put his gun away, leaned against the wall, and said,
Must have been pretty upsetting to see him like that.
Bobby nodded and wiped his face on the sheet, looking anxious.
Yeah, it was.
He went to see Drake sometime really early this morning, right? Asked Dash. Look, Bobby, I don't give a damn what you had going on with Drake. I just want to hear any information you might have so we can find out why Drake did what he did.
You're in no trouble, Bobby, Archer added. And what you tell us goes no further. Bobby glanced at Dash, who nodded.
That's right, son.
Bobby grew calmer and sat up against the headboard.
I usually go to see Mr. Drake around 3 in the morning, unless he tells me not to the night before.
Why at that hour?
Well, the ladies are sure to be asleep by then, and...
Okay, so you went there around 3?
Bobby nodded.
His bedroom door, see, I can walk right in off the rear veranda. Don't have to go into the house.
We saw your footprints, noted Dash, and saw that the door was unlocked.
Well, I opened the door and walked in like usual, and there he was.
Bobby's eyes filled with fresh tears.
It was like he was staring at me, but he was all dead and everything.
Did you touch the body? Asked Dash.
No, sir, he said quickly. I just turned and ran back here, and I've been here crying the whole time. I mean, Mr. Drake was real good to me. I can't believe he's gone.
Dash glanced at Archer.
Now, Bobby, this is real important, okay?
He paused and drew closer to the bed.
When did the men come out here? You saw them, right?
Bobby looked at him in surprise.
How'd you know about that, mister?
I didn't, at least not for sure until now. Tell me about it.
About 20 minutes after I got back here, I heard a car pull up, real quiet-like. I looked out the window. They had stopped right near the garage. 2 men got out and went over to Mr. Drake's bedroom door. They opened it, but didn't go inside. But I saw a light flashing around.
Archer said, That's why we only saw one set of footprints, Bobby's. Bobby said,
Then they closed the door and got in their car and drove off.
2 big lugs with stupid faces, said Dash.
Yeah, that's right. I saw them clear enough in the light next to the garage door.
Hank and Tony, said Archer. They were here. Dash edged over to him and spoke in a low voice.
That's why they took Kemper, Archer. With Drake dead, Kemper is the mayor. Armstrong can't have that.
So Drake must have called Armstrong and told him what he was going to do. That's why you mentioned back there about him maybe calling somebody?
And the 2 goons came here to make sure Drake wasn't bluffing. See, that was the ace in the hole Drake always had. Armstrong just figured he'd never play it, because it meant Drake would end up 6 feet under. But old Drake had his principles, and he was apparently sticking to them. He wasn't going to be Armstrong's rubber stamp, no sir. Got to admire the guy for that. I would like to think he died with that thought in mind and a smile on his lips.
He turned back to Bobby.
Drake ever talked to you about the campaign for mayor, or Sawyer Armstrong?
No, sir. We never talked about stuff like that.
Okay. You got somewhere you can go, or people you can stay with?
Bobby shook his head.
I ran away from home a few years ago when...
He looked at them anxiously.
Yeah, I understand. Okay, Ruthie knows that Drake is dead. She knows we came over to speak with you. For now, you just play dumb, okay? You don't know anything. You got that, Bobby?
Sure. Okay. Hey, mister, with Mr. Drake dead, will I have to leave here? I don't have no other place to go.
Dash looked uncomfortable.
I could lie to you, son, and say you can stay here for as long as you want. The fact is, Bobby, I have no idea. But for right now, you can stay, okay?
Okay. Thanks.
He looked past them and out the window toward the house.
He was a really nice man. He treated me okay, he really did.
He wiped his face on the sheet again, but it came away looking as tear-streaked as before.
Unfortunately, all good things must come to an end sometime, noted Dash. And for some people in this town, all I see are bad times coming.
Chapter 67 Archer and Dash pulled away in the Delahaye as the dawn kept creeping up on them. Archer said, "Where would they have taken Kemper? And what's Armstrong's game? How's he going to get out of this one?"
"From his point of view, he's home free. He just has to get rid of Kemper, and his star keeps shining bright. No one will ever point their finger at him. Kemper was his beloved son-in-law. Armstrong was supporting his campaign. He loved and respected the man. He shows up after he gets arrested and tells you to do all you can to save the man. They'll cry some crocodile tears when and if they find his body, and that'll be it."
"But if we find out that he was the one who snatched Kemper?"
"He'll be nowhere near that, Archer, with an unshakable alibi. And he won't have used Hank and Tony. Some boys from out of town were no doubt paid to do the job and keep their mouths shut later."
"So what do we do then?"
"We find Kemper."
"He could be anywhere, though." Dash looked at him and smiled.
"I think we need to go to the hospital."
"But Ernie Prettyman is unconscious. He can't tell us anything."
"This has nothing to do with Ern. I just want to prove to myself that Armstrong isn't as smart as he thinks he is."
Baytown General Hospital was a large, whitewashed building, 4 stories tall, with lots of windows, a flat face, and no interesting architectural elements. It looked about as appealing to enter as a morgue, at least to Archer.
"Look here, Archer. While I'm in here checking things out, I want you to go to the Occidental building and see if Beth Kemper's there. You said she has an apartment there. It's only 1 block over in that direction."
He pointed to his right.
"Beth? Why would she be there?" "For some reason, I don't think she wants to be any place right now that has an A on the gates."
"You think she knows her husband's been taken?"
"Doubtful. So I want you to tell her. And then I want you to persuade her to throw in her lot with us. She needs to tell us where Armstrong might have taken her hubby."
"You think she'll tell us?"
"Depends on how persuasive you are."
Archer dropped Dash off, and Dash told Archer he would meet him at the Occidental as soon as he could. Then Archer parked the Delahaye at the curb and got out. He stared up at the facade of the Occidental building. It was constructed of white and brown slabs of stone, with emerald green slashes thrown in, probably to make the architect happy. A long burgundy awning was emblazoned with the name of the place, in case the 2-foot-high chrome letters on the side of the building weren't clear enough. There was a doorman out front, wearing a black top hat and a long coat the same color as the awning, with brass buttons and a vest the color of a British red coat. Long white gloves covered his hands. A cab whistle dangled on a chain around his neck. To Archer, the man looked as embarrassed as he probably felt wearing that getup. He walked over to the man and said, "Hey, pal, checking to see if Beth Kemper is at her place here?" The gent looked him up and down in a disinterested way.
"Who wants to know?"
Archer produced his PI license, which had about as much effect as if he'd stuck out his tongue and tried to pull the guy's pants down in a fit of mild mischief.
"You'll have to do a lot better than that," said the man, and he looked like he meant it.
"Then Lincoln wants to know." The man looked dubiously at the single bill Archer held out. "And his twin brother," Archer added, producing a second 5-spot.
"Lady is in, and it's apartment 411, pal," said the man, sliding the 2 Lincolns into one of his numerous pockets.
Archer cleared the set of double doors and took the stairs up to the 4th floor. He hurried down to 411, knocked on the wood, and did it twice more before there was a response.
"Who the hell is it?"
called out Beth Kemper.
"Archer, we need to talk. It's about your husband."
He could hear feet running toward the door, and it was thrown open a moment later. There stood Kemper in a nightgown and bare feet, her hair disrupted by sleep.
"Yes?"
she said breathlessly.
"What about Douglas?"
Archer took off his hat and said, "Can I come in?"
"Yes, yes, of course."
He stepped through, and she closed the door behind her.
"Have you proven that Douglas didn't kill those people?"
Archer sat in a chair and waited until she did the same. "No, we haven't. Not yet. But there have been developments. Lots of them."
"What developments?"
"For starters, Alfred Drake shot himself this morning at his home. He's dead." Her hand flew to her bosom.
"Oh my God. Why would Alfred do that?"
"Let's just say he played his winning card. He didn't want to be your old man's lackey as mayor."
"That's ridiculous. My father wasn't backing Drake."
"You're right about that. He was blackmailing him."
"Blackmail? I don't understand, Archer."
"You don't have to, but it's true. Drake was a key to the casinos that were going to go up on that hunk of rock out there your father bought. Your husband would never agree to do his dirty work, so he couldn't be allowed to be mayor. Your father was the one who sent the blackmail note to your hubby. He was the one who had Fraser and Sheen killed. And now he, with the help of Chief Pickett, is framing Douglas for the twin murders, and hoping he spends his last few minutes on Earth breathing in cyanide in the gas chamber at San Quentin.
You must be mad,
she said breathlessly.
Even if what you say about the election is true, my father wouldn't have to try to frame Douglas for murder and see him executed.
He already executed Benjamin Smalls, so what's one more? She stood, her fury evident in the reddened cheeks, the slash of her mouth, and the trembling arm that was pointing to the door.
You just get up and march the hell out of here. I never want to see your lying face again. Do you hear me?
Well, you're going to have to endure it for just a while longer. By the way, do you know your blood type? This comment might very well have been the only thing that Archer could have said to stop the lady in her tracks.
What?
Your blood type. Everyone has one. Mine's AB.
I'm a B,
she said slowly. Okay. Do you know your mother's blood type?
No, I don't.
How about your father's?
No,
she snapped, obviously growing irritated at these queries. How about Sawyer Armstrong's? She started to say something, but as she got the point of his question, the look on her face made Archer tense.
What exactly do you mean by that?
She said in a low and threatening voice. I think you know exactly what I mean.
How dare you? You are a lying filthy—
They killed Myron O'Donnell last night, and the only things missing from his office were the medical records for you, your mother, and Sawyer. See, the doc had all three of them. He'd had your mother's and Sawyer's for a while, but then you just had your appendix operation. And Sawyer realized that what O'Donnell could have seen from that was that 1 + 1 does not equal you. Archer barely caught her before Kemper hit the floor in a dead faint. He picked her up and carried her into the bedroom. He laid her down on the bed, propped up against the pillows, found some smelling salts in her medicine cabinet, and also poured out a snifter of brandy from the small bar set up on a stainless steel rolling table in the front room. The salts did their duty, and she jerked and sat up, gasping. He gently but firmly pushed her back against the pillows and held up the snifter. "Drink this," he said. "It won't make you feel any better, but it won't make you feel any worse either." She took the drink without a word and finished it in one impressive swallow.
If you're lying to me, Archer.
I don't have anywhere near that sort of imagination, Beth. They shot O'Donnell, made it look like a narcotics job, and slit the poor elevator guy's throat just like they did Fraser. Kemper dropped the empty glass on the bed, slowly sat up, and put her face in her hands, and started moaning. Archer gripped her shoulder. I didn't mean to drop this on you like an A-bomb, but you needed to know. Through her hands, she said,
You mentioned that you had news of Douglas?
You might need some more brandy. She shuddered and lowered her hands. She looked up at him hopelessly.
Please, please don't tell me that he's—
He's not dead, but the jury's still out on whether he will be. That's why we need your help. She shuddered again and said in a whisper,
I have whiskey out there.
I have whiskey in here, he replied, pulling out his pocket flask and handing it to her. She took a swallow, handed it back to him, and said,
Now, tell me what's happened to Douglas.
They took him from his jail cell. They knocked out the guys that Willie had set up to guard him.
Why? Why take Douglas?
With Drake out of the picture, he's the mayor by default. Sawyer can't have that.
And you really have proof that he's not my father?
We're trying to get it. And even though you fainted back there, something tells me that you're not as surprised by that as you should be. She wouldn't look at him. But she didn't have to. The eyes welling with tears, and the tremble of her delicate mouth were enough.
He didn't always act like a father around me.
Yeah, he also found it difficult allowing anyone to grow close to you. Benjamin Smalls, your husband. Archer paused for a moment, and then decided to launch it. Your mother? She didn't move even the tiniest of her muscles. She just sat there staring at nothing. Like nothing was the most fascinating thing ever. We talked to your husband in jail before he got snatched. He said the idea for the luncheon that day was Sawyer's. He insisted you be there. So your mother went solo, right into the Pacific. That's what happened, right, Beth? Douglas said the light went out of your marriage then. He thought you blamed him. But did you? She looked up at him with such a sorrowful expression that Archer's mouth started to tremble.
I questioned Sawyer on what happened to my mother.
You questioned him on whether he sabotaged your mother's plane?
It took all the nerve I had, and he answered my question with a question.
She broke down at this point, and seemed to be struggling to keep from collapsing. Archer just held the woman for a long minute in silence, except for her sobs. When they finally subsided, Archer handed her back the flask and said, "Just finish it, Beth. The whiskey and your story. You can do this." She drank the whiskey, but held on to the flask, gripping the metal hide like it was her last attachment to life. Her words came in a rush, like they'd been bottled up inside of her for 2 centuries instead of a mere 2 years.
"He said he wondered whether people would think it odd that I didn't go up with my mother that day, that I should have been with her, but let something as unimportant as a luncheon prevent me from being with her, when she might have most needed me. Because a second pair of hands, even untrained ones, and another mind to troubleshoot the situation might have made all the difference."
She stopped and stifled a sob as she leaned her head against Archer's chest. "In other words, he guilted you." She glanced up at him.
"He did worse than that, Archer. He made me doubt myself."
"What possible motivation would you have to kill your mother?"
"Oh, he supplied that too."
She ran her fingers down the flask, as though it held all the answers she needed, only in Braille.
"He again wondered whether others would think I wanted her out of the way, so I could be the reigning queen of the Armstrong family. He even suggested that some might think with Eleanor gone, he was the only one standing in the way of my inheriting a vast fortune. He joked that he would have to watch himself around me."
"I think you needed to watch yourself around him."
"So he's really not my father?"
"No, he's not." They both looked up to see Dash, standing in the doorway holding a piece of paper.
"Now we just need to find Armstrong, because when we find him, we find your husband. Do you know where he might take Douglas if he intended that the man would never come back alive?"
Beth Kemper nodded.
"I do, Willie. He would have taken Douglas to the cliffs, his little retreat high up in the mountains."
"Can you tell us how to get there?"
"Yes, I can."
Chapter 68.
They cost me 2 sawbucks and a promise to the records clerk that I'd provide him with some lascivious details about some of my cases, said Dash.
Dash and Archer were in the Delahaye starting their climb up into the mountains. Daylight had brought increasing clouds, and a huge storm system was coming in off the water like an armada, ready to do some serious business. The mists and fogs were already making their ascent treacherous. They had stopped at the office, where Dash had picked up something that he said would probably be necessary. When Archer saw it, he couldn't disagree with the man's logic.
"Why would the clerk want to know those sorts of details?" asked Archer. "He's really a Hollywood screenwriter masquerading as a records clerk, at least in his own mind."
Changing gears, Dash said,
"So the cliffs, Armstrong's little retreat high up in the mountains. A man might just go up there and have an accident."
"But if he kills Kemper, surely the jig is up for him."
"Why, particularly if the body's never found? Armstrong's already laid the groundwork for Drake's campaign being backed by Vegas mobsters. Then Drake offs himself, and the mobsters are getting concerned because their guy is out of the race and Kemper is the only game in town for the mayor slot. They get to him in jail and ask for his loyalty. He refuses. So what do? They take him and kill him, and the mob guys disappear and are never seen again. Where does Armstrong come into the equation in a court of law? He'll have 12 alibis that he and his goons were nowhere near the jail because they weren't. And what evidence do we have that he had Fraser killed, except for an affidavit by a lady who's so scared of Armstrong that if she does come back and testify, she'll probably claim we killed everybody instead of Armstrong being behind it?"
"So that's why we're heading up to the cliffs? To rescue Kemper?"
"Yes, but Archer, pull off the road. I don't want you getting us into an accident when I tell you what I have to."
Archer stopped on the shoulder and stared at the man. "What are you talking about?"
"I made 2 phone calls from the hospital. One to Connie, she's fine. The other call I made was to Midnight Moods."
"Why'd you call there?"
"The thing is, Archer, we have to assume that Armstrong knows all that we know, okay? So knowing what we know, what does the guy do?
Well, if he thinks we're coming after him, he might want to get some leverage on us.
That's exactly right. Now, Connie is the only person in this town I really care about, but like I told you, she's safe.
He stopped and stared expectantly at Archer, who, to his credit, had seized on where Dash was going halfway through his last sentence. They have Liberty. You called Midnight Moods and she's gone.
I'm sorry, Archer.
Archer drove the car back on the road.
No, Willie, you're wrong there. They're going to be the ones who are sorry.
The rain started to fall a quarter of the way up. Halfway up, they could barely see out of the windscreen. The fog was so thick, fledgling day had been turned into night. Archer was gripping the wheel so hard his forearms were growing weary. All he could think about was Liberty, and what they might be doing to her right now. Especially Hank and Tony. He suddenly realized something.
Wait a minute. What'd you find at the hospital? Exactly what I hoped to find. Now don't ask me any more. Just concentrate on your driving,
he added as a curve shot up. Archer had to brake and cut the wheel hard to navigate it. The edge of the Delahaye came perilously close to a 1,000-foot drop.
You scared?
He asked. I don't mean by the ride up, but when we get there.
Well, I'm not stupid, Archer, so of course I'm scared. How about you?
Yeah, but it's neck and neck with anger in me.
Channel both to your advantage. Armstrong won't be alone, and there's hostages, so it's complicated.
Archer fought the storm 2,000 feet higher. The farther up they went, the worse it got.
Finally, Dash said, "Slow it down, Archer. From what Beth told us, the place is right at the end of that road."
Okay. He turned down the road, and then stopped the car.
Cut the lights.
Archer did so. They didn't bother to try to see what was up ahead. Even God was probably having a hard time doing that this morning.
She gave us the layout of the place, said Dash. We need to hit it from front and rear. Which one do you want?
I've always been partial to the back door.
Smart man, me too. So seniority here dictates that you go in through the front.
Dash took a moment to remove from the floorboard what he had brought.
You ready, soldier?
He asked.
I thought Liberty was worth dying for in the war, and my opinion hasn't changed.
They moved off silently into the darkened mist. Chapter 69 Archer moved just like he had as a scout in the 8th Army, first in Italy and then in Hitler's Rhineland. That is, he moved like a ghost. And next to him, Willie Dash did the same. They had grilled Beth on landmarks around the cliffs, and Archer and Dash came upon one of them. It was one of the largest oaks Archer had ever seen. But either lightning had struck it years before, or a forest fire had come through at some point. It still clung to the dirt, a blackened husk of electrified wood that was apparently too stubborn to fall down. They passed that, and they had 300 yards to go before they got to the log cabin that was Armstrong's sanctum sanctorum, according to Beth, a place he came to think and brood and plot the doom of others, Archer figured. At that point, he and Dash parted company. Before he disappeared into the mist, Dash said,
Good luck, Archer. But it won't really come down to luck, will it?
No, it won't. A few moments later, Archer slowed his pace and looked to his left and right. No one guarding these premises would think that anyone coming by stealth would stick to the road. They would be watching the paths and trails that meandered through here like a chipmunk on a stroll looking for its next meal. So stick to the road, Archer did. After another 100 feet, he looked to his right and squatted low. The man was neither Tony nor Hank, but he was about the same size. Armstrong apparently liked his henchmen in one size only, extra large. Archer took a widened route and came up on the man's rear flank as he sat there on a rickety chair behind a rock that was, apparently, his cover. He was smoking. That was his first mistake. He was nipping something from a bottle. That was his second mistake. His third and final mistake was having his .44 holstered. He never sensed anyone, until Archer introduced himself by parking the muzzle of his .38 against the fellow's skull.
The lady you took, she okay?
Said Archer, in a voice that brooked nothing but a straight answer. About 2 pounds of trigger pull, and the mistake-prone guard was a dead man.
Yeah, she's okay,
the man hoarsely answered.
You lying to me, I'll be back. And what I'll do to you, you'll never forget right till the moment you close your eyes for the last time. You understand me? Nod or say yes, because I need confirmation.
The man nodded.
A sharp blow from the butt of the .38 put a depression in the fellow's head, and he slumped forward, hit the rock, and slid off the side into the dirt. The fog was so thick Archer could barely see the gent a foot below him. He took off the man's suspenders and used them to hog-tie his wrists and ankles together. One down. Who the hell knew how many to go? But Archer would get to every last one of them to bring Liberty back safe and sound. Archer kept going, and the log cabin came into view around a bend strewn with fallen rocks. Two big sedans were parked out front, looking as out of place there as a horse at a dog show. And one of them was Pickett's Town and Country. Lights were on inside, and Archer could see a power line snaking from a tall pole to the side of the cabin. There was no guard out front, and Archer realized the tactic Armstrong was employing. He's pulled back, built his interior line, and he's daring us to cross it. The next step Archer took, he stumbled over a small fallen branch, cracking it in half. The sound shot through the misty air like cannon fire. The voice calling out to him sounded confident and unsurprised, and also confirmed Archer's theory. Armstrong said,
"Willie, is that you? Please come in and have a drink. I know it's still the morning, but this evening is guaranteed to none of us, unfortunately."
Archer made no move to do as the man asked.
"Archer, if you're out there too, I want you to know that your lady friend is a feisty one. I don't think I've seen a woman get hit harder and not even one little moan. I have to respect that. Now come in here and let's discuss this rationally."
The next sound Archer heard was Liberty screaming. This was followed by someone roaring with laughter.
"Okay, that one got her, yes, sir. I knew there had to be some point of vulnerability. I mean, she is flesh and blood. And what flesh and blood she is."
Archer watched as the front door to the cabin slowly opened, but no one appeared.
"Now the next sound you hear from this young lady will be her death rattle," Armstrong called out.
"Archer, don't!"
cried out Callahan. The next sound was a dull thud, like something hard hitting a watermelon.
All right," called out Archer. "I'm coming in. Lay off her. Without your weapon. And take her jacket and belt off."
Archer did so because he had no choice. He decided against trying to wedge the .38 in the rear of his waistband, because without the belt, his pants were bound to sag, which was why Armstrong had demanded that he shed his jacket and belt. He walked slowly toward the open door and passed through. He immediately felt cold metal against his neck. He knew without looking that it was a man with a gun. He surveyed the area in front of him as the door was close behind him. Sawyer Armstrong was sitting in a rocking chair, a thin, dark cigar stuck in his mouth. His straw hat was on his head, and his faded blue shirt was neatly tucked into dark brown corduroys. Next to him was Hank. Next to Hank was Tony, who looked like he wanted to claw Archer's eyes out of their sockets, and that was just for starters. Douglas Kemper sat on the floor with stout rope bound around his arms and legs. Next to him was Liberty, dressed in the robe they probably let her put on before they insisted at gunpoint that she leave her nice suite of rooms at Midnight Moods on her very first night there. He looked at her, and she looked back at him. The blackened right eye matched the one on her left. She was holding her left arm funny, and though there was not a single tear in her eyes, Archer could see the pain the woman was in. He nodded at her, trying to convey a sense of calm in his look. He didn't know if she received it as such, but it really didn't matter. Not much mattered right now. Next to them was Carl Pickett, looking more nervous than Archer would have given the corrupt cop credit for. And on the right of Pickett was Steve Pritchard in plain clothes and looking even more menacing than normal, which was saying something.
"Now, Archer, where is Willie?" asked Armstrong.
"Probably having his breakfast back in town."
Armstrong shook his head. "There is no possible way he sent you up here alone. It was Beth who told you about this place, wasn't it?"
"With Drake dead, you seem to have lost your horse in the race," said Archer, ignoring the man's questions.
"That's the wonderful thing about horse racing, Archer. You can always find another ride."
"We told Beth, you know."
"You told Beth what?"
"Why you had O'Donnell killed." He looked at Hank and then Tony. "And did you have to kill Earl?"
"You mean the colored boy?" said Hank. "Hell, that don't count.
Archer turned back to Armstrong. Beth knows you're not her father.
What?
Gasped Kemper.
Now just hold on there, Archer, said Armstrong with a smile. You're getting way ahead of yourself. Where's your proof of that?
O'Donnell had it. That's why you took it.
You're not her father?
Snapped Kemper.
And who is?
Carl, said Armstrong sharply. I can't hear myself think. Take care of it.
Pickett looked at Pritchard, who clocked Kemper so hard he hit his head against the wall and slumped over onto Callahan's lap. She put her hands protectively around Kemper, even as blood from his nose and mouth leached onto a robe.
Leave him alone!
She cried out.
Now, Archer, said Armstrong in a scolding tone, you really can't go around spouting lies. When I see Beth, I will tell her the truth.
No, you won't, because the truth is, Andrew Smalls was her father. From Armstrong's expression, Archer could tell that Dash's theory on this point was correct. Archer continued, and while we're at it, you killed Andrew Smalls. You sabotaged Eleanor's plane, and you dunked Benjamin Smalls in his own tub.
My goodness, Archer, is there anyone I didn't kill?
Yeah, me.
Well, it's early in the day yet.
Pritchard guffawed at that one, but no one joined him, and he quickly grew quiet. Well, here I am, Armstrong, said Archer.
Yes, here you are. I would prefer that Willie was standing next to you. There aren't many in town that give me pause, but he's surely one of them. So where is he?
I don't know what to tell you. From his pocket, Armstrong produced a squat, black automatic pistol and pointed it at Callahan's head.
Now, I don't want to do this, Archer. She is a lovely young lady. Not in Beth's class, you understand, but not someone in whose pretty head you want to place a very large hole. So this will be the last time I will ask. Where is Willie?
For over 5 years, Archer had not heard the sound that exploded around all of them in the next moment. For the 3 years preceding that, he had heard it pretty much all the time. The windows shattered, and the wooden walls were hit with such force that pine shrapnel went flying off in all directions. An antler chandelier was blown loose from its tethers overhead and fell to the floor with an ear-splitting crash. Those standing dove for the floor. Those already on the floor looked to burrow into the planks. When they all looked up after the shooting stopped, Willie Dash was standing at the open back door holding his still-smoking Tommy gun.
Here I am, Sawyer.
He brandished the weapon.
I took this from Mob Barker's cold dead hands. Forgot the kick this sucker has, but it's an attention-getter.
Archer was already on his feet. He picked up the gun that his captor had dropped on his way to the floor. He pointed it at the guy and motioned with the muzzle for him to join the others. Pickett, Pritchard, Hank, and Tony slowly rose to their feet, looking stunned, perhaps, that they were still alive. Only Armstrong hadn't moved. He had remained sitting in his rocking chair, and he still held his gun, and he looked not intimidated at all. Dash slowly came forward, his Tommy gun leveled at Armstrong.
While it would give me great pleasure to empty the slugs remaining in this gun's drum into your face, Armstrong, we need to jaw a bit before I seriously consider doing that. I'm all attention, Willie, said Armstrong, still not lowering the gun. First things first, put down the gun. I will, if you and Archer will. Was the casino really worth all this?
Asked Dash. Armstrong looked animated by the question.
I calculate it would be worth at least $50 million a year, and even to me that's a lot of money.
How much money do you need? Barked Archer.
Well, to tell the truth, it's not really the money, it's the excitement. And I'm a man who's easily bored.
Archer said, and I guess your excitement level went up when Benjamin Smalls took a boat out there, found out what you were planning, and was going to find a way to stop it.
But then, most conveniently, he died.
You mean you murdered him?
A murder charge requires proof. You have none.
Dash took a bulky envelope from his pocket and tossed it to Archer.
But Sawyer, you messed up. Hospitals are a business, you know. They have to document everything, and everybody has to get their copies. One copy for the patient, one for the doc, and one for the hospital.
Armstrong said nothing to this, but Archer could see the man run his tongue over his lips to moisten them. Dash said,
"Read it out, Archer. First line on each page."
Archer jammed his gun into his waistband, opened the envelope, and took out the papers. He looked down at them. Eleanor Armstrong, blood type A. He flipped to the next page. Sawyer Armstrong, blood type also A. Archer glanced up. Beth told me her blood type is B.
"It is," said Dash, "which means Armstrong can't be her father. Two A's can't produce a B, at least when it comes to blood types."
"You bastard, I knew something was off with you."
This came from Kemper, who had regained consciousness and was sitting there listening with Callahan's arm still draped protectively around him.
"Very off," said Dash. "In his weird, creepy mind, he had to kill off anyone who grew close to Beth. Why is that, Sawyer? You want her for yourself?" "Well, for starters, unfaithful wives don't deserve a lot of respect in my book,"
he replied calmly. Too calmly, thought Archer.
"Married to you, I don't wonder why she got the wandering eye, particularly when it seems all you wanted to do was dominate the daughter that really wasn't yours, not love the woman who really was your wife," countered Dash. "So I have a gun, and you have a gun. How do you see this ending, Willie?" "My gun has a lot more bullets. All I need is one."
In an instant, he pointed the gun directly at Archer.
"When you shoot me, I shoot Archer. Care to sacrifice your new boy, Willie? Like a good racehorse, you can always find another."
For the first time, Dash looked uncertain of the outcome. At least it looked that way to Archer, who was staring at him.
"No reason to do that, Sawyer. It's a fair and square game, just admit it. You don't need to go down in a blaze of glory like Dillinger, because it's not a blaze of glory, it's just dead." "Don't begrudge me taking one of your pawns," said Armstrong, "as my final act."
The bullet was fired, and everyone just stood there, except for Callahan and Kemper, who stared open-mouthed from their seats on the floor. Armstrong seemed to be the last person in the room to comprehend that he was the one who had been shot. He finally looked down curiously at the gaping hole in his chest. He looked up and saw Beth Kemper standing in the doorway, the smoking gun she held still pointed resolutely at him, like an accusatory finger demanding justice. Beth Kemper looked prepared to take a second shot. However, Sawyer Armstrong slid dead to the floor, so it didn't seem necessary to kill the man twice. Kemper calmly set the gun down on a table, walked over to her husband, knelt beside him, and hugged him as tightly as she could. Callahan moved her arm away and looked at Archer. He was not looking back. He was watching Dash, whose gaze was squarely on the dead man. When he finally looked up to see Archer staring at him, he shrugged and said,
"Now that takes the cake."
Chapter 70. Several days later, around lunchtime, Archer drove to the office and rode the elevator up, pushing the necessary buttons as Earl no longer could. He said hello to Connie Morrison, who smiled sweetly at him, and told Archer that Dash wanted to see him. Archer pecked on the man's door and was told by a gruff voice to enter. Dash was on the davenport, his shoes off, his feet up, and his jacket off. He had a tumbler of scotch in one hand and a cigar in the other.
"Take a seat."
Archer sat.
"First things first, I got five names for your license application. You'll be happy to know that both Carl Pickett and Steve Pritchard signed the list, their last official acts before they retired from the force."
"Retired, huh? How come?"
"I strongly suggested it, and they finally agreed."
"So who's going to be the new chief?"
"I've told Earn to make a run for it. He's young, smart, talented, honest as the day is long, which means he doesn't have a chance in hell of getting the job."
"Okay."
"I'm writing a letter to the Board of Prison Directors. Connie will include that with the application she's typing up now for your signature. It basically says you're a hell of a gumshoe, or of outstanding moral character, and helped solve a big case and saved a bunch of lives, blah, blah, blah. You'll get the license."
"But you said they might do their own investigation into me, my background. Hell, I killed a lady down in Ventura, even though it was in self-defense."
"Yeah, I made discreet inquiries into that, Archer, through some PIs I know down there. The lady's body was found,
The cops did their investigation, and they concluded that it indeed looked like self-defense. She had fired two rounds into the chair I assume you were sitting in. She missed, you didn't. They're really going to leave it like that?
You deduced that the lady was selling drugs.
Well, the cops down there were already looking her way on that as well. So the consensus in Ventura is she got what was coming to her. End of story. Damn, I didn't expect that. Second thing, the Kempers added another 9 grand to the retainer already paid, for a total of 10,000 in appreciation of a job well done, and a cancer named Sawyer Armstrong no longer being in their lives. So my money problems are over for now, at least. That's great. So what is my salary, and when do I start getting paid? Connie didn't know, and you never said. Third thing, all the folks who are at the Cliffs are keeping their trap shut. Pickett and Pritchard, Hank and Tony, and the other two goons know they're looking at murder and kidnapping and assault charges and a long stint in the big house if they say one word. So we're good there. Now, in an ideal world, they'd all be going to the slammer or the gas chamber. But proof is hard to come by, and I doubt Hank and Tony can make a living without Armstrong around. They'll melt into the dirt like a water lily in the Sahara. And Pickett and Pritchard are leaving town, and good riddance. Okay. Fourth thing. Beth inherited everything that Armstrong had, so she's even richer than she was, and Douglas is going to be the new mayor. So that hunk of rock out there will stay a hunk of rock. And it looks like with Armstrong out of the way, those two are going to make it. True love wins out, right? Right. And fifth? There is no fifth, except what's in that bottle of scotch over there. Okay, I'm done, Archer. Go off and play today.
Archer rose and headed to the door.
Dash said, Hey, Archer.
Yeah?
You got the makings of a decent gumshoe. Just keep at it, okay?
Archer nodded.
That wasn't really Ma Barker's Tommy gun, was it?
Who the hell knows? But when you pick up a weapon like that, you gotta do it with style.
Archer signed his application, and Morrison said she would be mailing it out that day. And then she did something that surprised Archer. From behind a vase of flowers, she lifted up a long-stemmed glass with some liquid in it.
What's that? Asked Archer.
Champagne, of course. Lots to celebrate. You want a glass?
Thanks, but I'm saving myself for something a little more amber in color.
He crossed the reception area and went into his office. He sat down at his desk and noted the single sunflower that presumably Morrison had put in the vase. It was already drooping from lack of sun. Archer moved it to the windowsill, and it seemed to perk right up. There was a knock on his door.
Yeah?
It opened, and there stood Dash.
Forgot something, Archer.
He took out his wallet, peeled off 8 C-notes and 10 Jacksons, and handed them to Archer.
They're weekly wages. Just don't expect that kind of dough every time, capiche?
Thanks, Willie, said Archer.
Now how about using some of it to buy me lunch?
I know a place down by the water.
I know you know a place down by the water. Only my gams aren't nearly as fetching as Beth Kemper's, so don't get your hopes up, son.
Hey, I wonder if they serve cream of wheat. The two men walked out into the clearest sky Archer had seen since he'd been in Baytown.
Chapter 71 Early the following afternoon, Archer drove to Midnight Moods. Mabel Dawson was back from Long Beach, and she nodded to him as he walked in.
Long time no see, Archer.
Yeah, I can't seem to stay away from this place.
This place is under new management,
she added.
Beth Kemper came by this morning. Told me no reason to change a ship's course mid-voyage, though she did say the girls can't have visitors at lunchtime.
They were probably bad for the digestion anyway.
You're here to see Liberty, I suppose?
I am.
Well, considering it's only just after 1, you'll probably find her in bed.
He headed up to Callahan's room and knocked on the door.
Yeah? Who is it?
It's Archer. You decent?
Same answer as last time, Archer.
The door opened, and there she stood in a sheer black silk number, her hair tousled and her face puffy from sleep. And she looked more beautiful than ever, Archer thought. If Beth Kemper was all cool class, Liberty Callahan was the white-hot flame of the working-class gal used to the rough and tumble of the world. And it wasn't a close competition which one intrigued Archer more.
Miss me?
He asked.
Yeah, you're all I've been thinking about, Buster.
She stepped back so he could pass through. He looked around and saw the few personal touches she had made to the place. How are your eyes? He asked, noticing they were still a bit swollen, but the black and yellow was fading back to pale white.
Nothing makeup can't take care of. Nobody notices when I'm doing my act. And my arm's all better where they twisted it.
Still packing the house?
What can I say? I'm a star.
Beth Kemper owns this place now.
Yeah, I heard. Good to see a woman taking charge.
So you still happy here?
Well, I signed a contract for a year, as you know. After that, I'll probably be taking a bus to Hollywood. That's where I need to be. I'm not getting a star turn in Baytown, at least the one I want.
She sat in a chair and crossed her legs, and that got Archer's attention. And he sat, too, and tried not to think about her leaving in a year or about how little she was wearing. She looked at his gloomy expression.
Why? You going to miss me?
She said. Yeah, I will, actually.
Don't make me get all weepy,
replied Callahan in a mocking tone, but her expression showed that his words had touched her. He twirled his hat between his fingers. Look, I came here to apologize for getting you involved in all this.
No need. Almost getting killed makes a girl feel more alive than a dozen roses, a plate of oysters on the half shell, or soaking in a tub full of Chanel No. 5.
She lit a cigarette, and Archer mimicked her. They blew smoke and stared across at each other, maybe both looking for some sign of something in the other. Decent of you to see it that way. She crossed her legs again and she said,
That's me, Archer. Decent to my core, as you can see for yourself.
So what are we really doing here? Said Archer.
Beats me. I'm just making it up as I go along. And in case you forgot, you knocked on my door.
Yeah, I did, he said, and then fell into an awkward silence. This was clearly not going how he intended.
You want a drink?
She asked in a helpful tone.
Sure, why not? Seems like everybody's drinking these days.
She rose and went to a small cabinet. She got down on her knees, opened one of the doors, and pulled out two glasses and a bottle of bourbon. He could see that the bottoms of her feet were pale and smooth, and that, of all things, made something go haywire in part of his brain. You know, technically, to be called bourbon, it has to be made in Kentucky, said Archer quickly, loosening his tie to allow more air to come in. She poured out three fingers each and said,
There goes the college boy again.
They sat and drank and stared at each other. Anything you want to tell me? Asked Archer.
Should there be something?
I don't know. That's why I'm asking.
I don't like running in circles. I get dizzy easily.
Archer was going to say something right back, but he took a page from his old friend Irving Shaw's book and slowed down. He looked at Callahan, and she looked right back at him. She just wanted to get out of Reno, just like Archer. She wanted to chase a dream to the West Coast, just like me. She saved both our lives up in those mountains. At first it had shocked him that a woman could do that. But if he'd had the gun and not Callahan, I would have shot all three and felt like a hero. She tries to be confident and in control, but it's sometimes just a show, because inside she's scared to death, just like me. We're actually a lot alike.
Archer, you still breathing in there, or should I call a doctor?
He came out of his musings. I'm here. He took a nervous sip of his drink. I know we both said some things we probably regret. At least I do.
It happens, Archer. But I think we both made up for it, right?
Yeah, I guess we did.
I mean, we've been through a lot. More than most married couples have, right?
I didn't come here to propose. She laughed a deep, throaty laugh that for some reason made Archer feel wonderful about himself.
I'm not ready to settle down, Archer. Not by a long shot. But if I ever did, well, I could do a lot worse than taking a ring from you.
He held up his glass to her and added a warm smile. She stretched her leg out and touched his shoe with her bare foot and kept it there.
So, that thing that happened in the mountains, are we good on that?
They killed Bobby H. They were going to kill us. They deserved what they got.
Hell, we let the little guy off easy.
You didn't think that back then,
she pointed out. And maybe I was wrong. She took a sip of her drink and studied what she had left.
No, you aren't, Archer. If I'd shot that little weasel in cold blood...
She shook her head.
I'm not sure what it would have done to me, but none of it would be good. So I have to thank you for doing what you did.
Okay.
I see their faces in my sleep,
she said quietly.
I see how they died.
Yeah, I suppose you do. She shot him an anxious look.
Does it ever go away?
Not completely, no. But you see the faces less and less as time goes on, and not nearly as clearly.
That's good to know.
But if you ever see them so much that you can't handle it, give me a call. I'll be right over.
You're a good man, Aloysius Archer.
Surprised you remembered my given name.
I plan to keep on surprising you. They say it's good for a relationship.
He grinned and took another swallow of his drink. Oh, so we have a relationship now?
I think so.
I actually know so, and I'm lucky for it.
Hell, we're just gushing over each other. I'm starting to feel giddy.
I'm feeling something, too, only it's not that. This was the first and only time he had ever seen Liberty Callahan blush. It was a lovely look on the woman.
You want to take me to lunch?
She said, a bit breathlessly. No, but I will take you to dinner.
So, what do we do in the meantime?
Archer put his glass down, took off his jacket, undid his tie completely, and started unbuttoning his shirt. If you have to ask, lady, then I'm really doing something wrong. She stood and slid her soft hand along his hard jaw.
Oh, you're not wrong, Archer. You just need to work on your timing is all. But I got at least a year to help you with that.
She took him by the hand, led him into her bedroom, and closed the door. Thank you for listening. This has been a Hachette Audio production of A Gambling Man, written by David Baldacci, read by Eduardo Ballerini and Brittany Presley, produced by Lisa Kahn, directed by Robert Kessler, post-production by John Colucci. Text copyright 2021 by Columbus Rose Limited. Audio production copyright 2021 Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.